to have this meeting together and convene this conversation between the House and the Senate. And you have the agenda before you. And we are going to really try to have these presentations kind of come together and make sure that we give plenty of time to members. So we're going to try to move our presenters quickly, and we're going to ask you to please stay for questions. We're going to go through the presentations, through the agenda, through item number 6, and then we're going to give at least an hour to members, because obviously we have a few members present, to really ask questions, because what we want is to give you a very brief overview. We invited people who are experts so that if you know if they didn't cover the information that you are looking for, if you had a question that you want to ask, they will be here to respond to those questions. So make sure you take some notes, and even if the presenters did not cover some of the material, they will be here, hopefully, to respond to those questions. Representative Moriani.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's good to see some of my colleagues who I haven't seen in several months. I have to say, one of the privileges I have in my life is to serve with people like you and a number of you I've been working with for a number of years, and we've done some really good work. It's my experience, Senator, that the education committees in both the House and the Senate, quite frankly, are some of the most bipartisan, thoughtful, deliberate committees that, quite frankly, are doing the most important work that our state requires us to do. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation today. As we engage with the testifiers, we'll learn more about why the Senator and I have chosen to really focus in on this issue. It's a really big issue that I don't think we spend enough time, unfortunately. And we're not alone. I mean, this is true across the nation. But as our student population changes, it's clearly an area that's going to require some powerful new thinking and some good competencies on our part. I know we want to keep moving, but I'm wondering, Senator, if perhaps maybe we might not want to go around the table very quickly, and just if the members can state their name and what district they're from, just in the rare event that some of us have forgotten who the others are here.
I think that's a great idea.
Very well.
That's a great idea. So why don't we start with the House members?
Sounds good. Representative Yaruso. We'll start that way, and we'll work our way around the room.
Thank you. Representative Yaruso, I represent Shoreview, Arden Hills, Moundsview, and a little bit of Spring Lake Park.
Representative John Benson, represent Minnetonka and Plymouth.
Representative Cruz, I represent District 9B, Little Falls. And is this the what did you do over summer break time?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Good to see you, Ron.
Summer break. Long time ago.
Representative Bud Nornes, I represent District 8A, which is kind of the west half of Otter Tail County.
Representative Sandra Erickson, I'm the GOP lead on education policy in the House, and I represent a part of East Central Minnesota. Princeton, Mille Lacs, Foley, Mora, Isle, Onamia school districts are among mine.
I'm Representative Anna Wills, and I represent 57B, which is Northern Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Coates.
I'm Will Morgan. I represent parts of Burnsville and Lakeville.
Kathy Breinert. I represent Mankato and Eagle Lake.
Go ahead, Peter.
Peter Grafstrom, a committee administrator for the House Policy Committee.
Carlos Mariani, St. Paul representative.
Patricia Torres-Ray, Minneapolis Richfield in the Senate.
Brad Kelly, committee administrator for the Senate Education Committee.
Representative David Bly, House 20B, Northern Rice County, and Eastern Lasur County.
Greg Clausen, I'm a member of the Senate. I serve District 57, which is Apple Valley, Rosemont, Northeast Lakeville, and the community of Coates.
Senator Kevin Dahl, Senate District 20, Northfield, and parts of Rice, Lasur, and Scott County.
I'm Melissa Wickland, and I represent Senate District 50, and that's Bloomington and Richfield.
I'm Mary Swatsky, and I represent District 17B, which is Wilmer, Newland and Spicer, Atwater area, and I'm a school teacher, and we have with a large population of Somali and Latino population.
I'm State Senator Jim Carlson, and I represent District 51, which is the northern part of Burnsville and most of Eagan, school districts 191, 196, and 197.
Dave Thompson, Senate District 58, live in Lakeville and serve Lakeville, Farmington, and Southern Dakota County right down to the Rice County border.
I'm Sean Nino, representing Senate District 32. That's most of Chisago and Isanti counties.
Thank you, members. It's a constant good reminder of how diverse and rich our state is. We're a big state, but we always find a way to pull together and do good common public policy on behalf of our young people. So as the senator mentioned, and by the way, I can't speak for the Senate members, but certainly for the House members, you should have your per diem forms in your packets, so make sure that you get to those so that we're doing the proper per diem for you for attending today's meeting. So as the senator mentioned at the beginning, we're not going to do a stop and question after each one. And so for the testifiers, just so you know that, but don't go away because we're going to have a pretty healthy time at near the end for members to ask questions. And so you may be jumping back and forth from your chairs to the testimony table. And so for members, if you can make sure you jot down those good, important questions and save them until after we're done with item 6 on the agenda. So with that, right now, and I'm going to take my watch off because I'm serious about this, we're going to spend 20 minutes hearing from the Department of Education. And so welcome to the joint committee hearing. If you can state your name for the record and give us your testimony, that'd be wonderful.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, good afternoon. My name is Jesse Montano. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education. Probably the in-house historian on this topic, which is very near and dear to my heart. I was instrumental in getting the first bill passed, and I'm not going to tell you when that was because that will give my age away.
You know, Assistant Commissioner, I actually know that date, but I won't blow it either. So.
I can tell you which governor it was. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. To my right is Lee Slisher. She's a supervisor for the EL program. And to my left is Assistant Commissioner Eliad Demayuga-Brugerman. She brings a whole different perspective to the department with respect to this population because she recently came to us from the public school district sector as well as experience in the non-public working with this population. So we're very pleased to have her and also the perspective that she brings to the issues that we're going to be talking about today. Our purpose this afternoon is to give you a brief overview in terms of the ELL population, who they are, where they are, and some of the services and resources that are available to them. Who are these English learners in Minnesota? Demographics, we have 65,689 English learners identified in school year 2013. 78% are enrolled in the 7-county metro area. 22% are enrolled in Greater Minnesota. 59% are enrolled in Hennepin and Ramsey County. These students are served in 315 districts and charter schools. The native language, the four highest native languages constitute 39% Spanish, 18% Hmong, 14% Somali, and 3% Karen.
I haven't seen her.
Distribution of these students in Minnesota with respect to districts. You've got 30.7%, roughly 31% of the districts serve anywhere from 1 to 9 students. Roughly 41% serve anywhere from 10 to 99 students. You can see the rest of those numbers. It's suffice to say that more than 70% of the districts in Minnesota serve fewer than 100 ELL students. But regardless of whether you're serving 100, 10, or thousands, their needs are similar, and the services that should be provided should not be less whether you've got one student versus thousands. Historically, Minnesota has been a large refugee resettlement state. It began in 1975 with the first group of Southeast Asians. Predominantly, they were Vietnamese. Refugees account for a large percentage of Minnesota's total foreign-born population than other states in the region. So if you look at our region, we have historically been one of the top states with respect to the resettlement of refugees. Started with Vietnamese and then went to Hmong, and we've seen added Somalis and so forth. 2007, 23% of the immigrants to Minnesota had entered as refugees, and in previous years, this number was as high as 40%. And those of you who know anything about refugees,
Ms.
they
Montaño,
come to us with numerous concerns.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I didn't have that handout, and there are some members who do not have it. So I want to make sure that everybody has that, because I presume I take notes on handouts so that I remember what questions to ask. Do you all have this handout?
Yes.
Okay. Could you let us know how many copies we need? Who needs a copy? Senator Nino, Wicklands, 1, 2, 3. We need about 4 copies.
Oh, looks like I need 1, 2, 5.
Whoops.
Please let Blanca know if you need a copy. Sorry for the interruption, but they do need this for notes. Thank you. If you could proceed. Sorry.
In year 2010, approximately 8-9% of Minnesota's foreign-born population was made up of refugees. Primary refugee arrivals in Minnesota, you can see from the numbers below, 54% Burma, and we do have a number of representations across the board from different different ethnic groups. Minnesota is home to the largest Somali community in the U.S., the second largest Hmong community in the U.S., one of the largest Liberian communities in the U.S., the largest Ethiopian population in the Midwest, the largest ethnic Oromo minority group in Ethiopia population in the U.S., and you can see there compared to other states that we're at the top. In terms of trend data and projections, you can see, and this takes it out to 2065, and I can guarantee you I will not be here in 2065. But you can see that the population of births to refugees is going to decrease, and that constitutes what we would look at second, third generation. But you can see in terms of the net migration, it does go down, but it does continue to be at a level. So we will continue to see immigrants come to Minnesota, although the newborn population will decrease. And, again, that constitutes the second, third generation. Depending on the background, some of these students do begin school speaking English. Most of them do not, at least second generation. By third, you can expect that there will be some English skills. Let's look at funding sources for ELL. As I said, I do go back to the first law that was passed. ELL state funding is part of the state compensatory aid formula. In school year 2013, roughly $39.6 million was paid in state aid for English learners. That constitutes an average of about $926 per pupil unit, roughly 42,500 average daily membership units. But interesting to note that in FY13, 18,242 EL students served in the EL program did not generate state aid because the cumulative ADM had exceeded 5 years. Staffing. The majority of Minnesota EL students are served in an English as a second language program. In the fall of 2013-14, 1,375 teachers holding an ESL license reported teaching in an ESL teaching assignment. Some English learners are served through bilingual programs, what we refer to sometimes as a two-way immersion or content support in the native language. 136 teachers and administrators hold a teacher license with a bilingual bicultural endorsement. However, this endorsement is not required for two-way immersion programs. So most of the teachers that work in an immersion program have a standard either elementary license or a content license. Let's look at federal funding. In 2013-14, we received from the Elementary Secondary Education Act under Title III funding for EL students. This funding provides supplemental education funds for English language development programs and professional development for teachers. Our state allocation is about $8 million. 137 districts and charter schools received these funds. 47 of these districts and charter schools served these students through participation in a consortium. You have to generate at least $10,000 in order to receive funds directly. If you don't generate at least $10,000, which constitutes about 100 students, then you need to join a consortium. So 47 of those districts and charter schools are part of a consortium. This constitutes about $110 per pupil funding.
And just a bit in terms of programs for English learners, Minnesota is a member of the World Class Instructional Design and Assessments Consortium, the WIDA Consortium. This consortium provides our English language development standards and assessments that we use when evaluating these programs. Our English language development standards are in rule, such as the content area standards in the content areas. And they are standards that are closely embedded to the content areas. So, and you can see the topics there, ranging from social and general instructional development to the language of math, the language of science, language of social studies, and the language of language arts. So not the content of those content areas, but the academic English involved in those content areas. These standards, such as the content area standards, are used by teachers in the classroom to support students in their various levels of development in English language within the content areas. The standards are used to inform instruction and curriculum, much as the Minnesota content standards. And as a member of this consortium for the past just over 2 years, MDE has provided training on a range of topics related to the implementation of standards, and districts have engaged in a lot of hard work in terms of implementing our standards framework. This framework that we're working with also comes with an annual assessment, which is known as ACCESS, ACCESS for ELLs, technically. Students take these tests K through 12 in late winter. The assessment window is open. And ACCESS consists of four domains when we're looking at English language development. We're looking at speaking, listening, reading, and writing components of English language proficiency. So students receive a composite score as well as a score in each of those domains that I mentioned before. It is administered in five grade clusters: kindergarten, 1-2, 3-5, 6-8, and 9-12. And using this data, we're able to group students into six proficiency levels. And you can see the names there. And these proficiency levels give teachers kind of a common language, a common across the state, to talk about students. And then I will pass it to...
Oh, that's you for me?
That's me. Okay. I won't pass it. In terms of performance of English learners, how are English learners performing within content areas? All English learners, just as background, all English learners take math and reading content assessments. Only a very small number of new-to-country students are exempt from taking the reading assessment. New-to-country means in the country 12 months or less at the time of testing. Otherwise, the group is included. And so let's take a look at proficiency levels. On the math, MCA 3, grades 3 through 8, can see 29% of English learners were proficient on the math MCA in 2013. It looks like that on my sheet. It's 29% in 2013. And then in grade 11, in 2013, only 8% of English learners were proficient on the math MCA. It did get cut off. Yeah, sorry about that. In terms of reading, in grades 3 through 8 and 10, 16% of English learners were proficient in reading in 2013. And lastly, a look at graduation rates over time. And as you can see, English learners in 2012, the graduation rate for this subgroup was 51.38%, so a slight increase in graduation rates for English learners there, but obviously there is a gap in this area.
As we previously introduced, my name is Elia Di Mayuga Brugeman, Assistant Commissioner for MDE. And as you were told before, prior to coming to the department, I have been a professor, a teacher, including ESL teacher and administrator in the Minnesota Public School as well as in the private school system. The information we provided today gives you a general overview of the EL population in Minnesota. Those of us here and the people who work with our English learners in our districts across the state know very well the extreme needs that exist with our ELL children in the K-12 system. These children have different backgrounds. They are immigrants. They are refugees. They are migrant workers. They are citizens of this country. They and speak a different language, such as the Latino, Somali, Hmong population, etc. We know that our English learners are the most disenfranchised of all students and are characterized by high mobility. From my personal experience as a classroom teacher and administrator, the ESL teacher has a mixture of students in the classroom who speak different languages. We know that in Minneapolis and St. Paul Public School, also in a rural community such as Worthington, we have many languages spoken in our schools. We also know that in the ESL classroom, we have students at different age level, and also with the different ability to speak English, as I mentioned before, a different language, but also a different grade level. We know that ELL students have little or no academic support at home. English learning students have a very high dropout rate, not only in Minnesota, but across the country. In other schools, they are marginalized by the community in which they live. They experience isolation. They feel disconnected to the school, which is intensified by the language barrier, achievement issues, and also retention. We must always remember that every child is an asset to the state, to this country, is an asset to their community, is an asset to their parents, and is an asset to their schools. The ELL children, as well as other students in our state, are our future workforce. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. And if you have questions, we will take them.
Thank you. Each of you. One of the fun parts of being a chair of a committee is that you can kind of change the rules occasionally. And so I was speaking with my center counterpart. I thought, 60 minutes of just us sitting here listening is not very conducive. So let me offer this bit of a compromise, because I do want to get through. We have a long list. What I'd like to do, Senator, with your permission, if it's okay, is to have a few questions come at you right now, but I don't want any answers right now. Just jot those down and come back ready to answer those questions, if you will. How does that sound?
Yeah, that'll be fine.
Okay.
Yeah, that'll be fine.
Because, again, I do want to honor the long list of folks that we have that we've asked to come forward. Originally, I said, let's just do the question and answer, but I think this might work a little bit better. We'll see. I don't know. So let me start off very quickly by asking, as I look at the performance outcomes measured by our standardized measurements, they look pretty bleak. And I note that we don't, at least as evidence before us, we don't have, it doesn't appear that we have a deep set of longitudinal data to be able to do any kind of conclusive, I think, conclusions about trends. And so tell us about trends. If anything, it looks like perhaps we're not even trending upward in terms of these outcomes. And so if you can come back and be prepared to talk about trends, and then also talk, if you when you come back, about, and I know, you know, I don't believe in magic bullets, but, you know, if you can identify two or three major things from a policy perspective that this legislature could be doing relative to a powerful intervention that can contribute to reversing either a trend here or certainly getting us a much better result. I think, Representative Erickson, you would agree with me that, you know, about a 50% graduation rate is just unacceptable for us as Minnesotans. And there's, as Commissioner Brueggemann shared, there's a lot at stake here. And we certainly can't, you know, we certainly can't build, I don't think, a really effective society here with those kind of outcomes. And I'm not passing judgment. I'm just, you know, stating the obvious here. So, members, quickly, if you can issue some questions and thoughts for the commissioners when they come back.
Senator Nelson.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I agree with the chair's comments about the need for longitudinal data. And that will kind of get to my question. I note that 51% four-year graduation rate truly is unacceptable anywhere. And but there is a piece of data that I'd like to get that isn't, I don't think it's in your presentation. I think that's also the graduation rate for the Minneapolis public schools. And I note that a good, the majority of ELL students reside in 78% in the seven-county metro area, 59% in Hennepin and Ramsey, and 22% in greater Minnesota. So as we try and look at this really dismal graduation rate, we have to try and pinpoint what's working and what are the issues that are causing this low graduation rate. And one of the things that I think would be helpful would to help us better identify if it's something specifically with ELL or if it's in perhaps part of the larger Minneapolis graduation rate, whatever those concerns are, or maybe it's the same. But to know what is that four-year graduation rate for the 22% of ELL students that are in greater Minnesota. And then also I'd like to, if we have data, I'd like to know what's working. I know some states are doing individualized learning curriculum, particularly for ELL kids, and they've had great success. And I'm wondering if you have data for that as far as what strategies are taking place in Minnesota and what are the results of those strategies. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Sawatsky, and then followed by Senator Dino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be on slide number 16 when it talks about the MCAs and the new-to-country students are exempt from the reading test, but curious as to how the math test is presented and if in other testing with the MCAs, I know that math today is a lot of reading, and so just was wondering what the logic or the discussion is on why the reading test is exempt but not the math test, or at what point are there modifications and adaptations for the reading part of the math, or is it 100% calculation? Then that could clear up some questions.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Nina, followed by Representative Yaruso.
I'm good.
Okay. Senator Representative Yaruso, and then Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know whether the data we get, whenever this kind of data is presented, if we can distinguish between, does it include all students that qualify as English language learners, or does it exclude those who have timed out after the 5 years? And then I was just curious, are students who use ASL at home ever included among English language learners for the purpose of reading and writing?
Very well. Thank you. Representative Erickson and then Representative Quisha. And at that point, Senator, I think we'll move on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Shamar Ayani and Senator Torres-Ray. My question for the department is, can you update us on the status of the longitudinal data system? There are always rumblings that it's not doing what it's supposed to do as it was spelled out by the dollars that were received several years ago, and that system has to be in place, and what protections also go along with the longitudinal data system. And then as I look at the percentages who are of students who are proficient, are they not included with other students? And I want to know, during the 5 years that there's the intensity going on in their learning of English versus what happens to them once they're past that. So, for example, if they begin in ELL at first grade, what happens after the 5 years, and are we tracking that progress toward proficiency at that point? So if you could clarify some of that, that is confusing me when I look at these percentages. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. I had some of the same questions. Representative Quisha, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Chair. And I think this dovetails a little bit into Representative Erickson's inquiries. And mine is, are we tracking this along the lines of families? So, for example, if you move here with one child and have three more, what happens as that family gets more and more proficient in English? And then what about those children if they marry and have another set of family? I'm just curious, at what point do we see some of the breaks within generations and so forth, if that makes sense? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quisha. And Representative Carlson, I think we confused Senator Nienau with Senator Carlson. So that's why we introduced each other, so that you had a question, apparently.
Yes, I did. I'm also interested in that the age out. It looks like we had, and I was doing some calculating here, 18,242 EL served in an EL program, but they didn't generate the compensation from that. And I guess what I'm thinking, too, and I think it representative was touching on that too, is the instruction continuing regardless of the compensation? And also, I'm thinking about that population of the 18,000. What's the characteristics of those? Are they living in households that are non-English speaking also? And does that make a difference? I'm sure it does, but I'd like to hear you say, what difference does it make if a student is living in a household that speaks English versus a household that does not?
Thank you, Senator. And finally, Senator Clausen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one comment, and I sometimes wonder if we aren't testing for negative results. As a high school principal, we've had people come to my school who are literate in their own language, and within 12 months we're testing them. And I just question whether that is realistic.
These are terrific questions and powerful questions. So if I may ask, when you come back, so we'll call you back up, if you can reference quickly the question, I'll have a list of who asked them, and then we'll try to quickly go through some answers.
And before you go, Representative Mariani, I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
There was a request that we made from the office. We have, from my office, we were given these numbers about the 65,000 children that are identified as ELL students, and how only 43%, I believe, generate funding for the districts. So we have a gap of about 22,000 children that are identified by the districts for whom the districts provide funding, is my understanding. I'm not clear on that, but I did ask that question. I would like to have a clarification. I think that what I would like to hear more about is really defining better the profile of these children and the needs of the different districts. We tend to really put a kind of blank, broad statements about who these children are and why we need more funding in order to serve them. But we've not done an in-depth analysis of who they are. In a brief analysis that we did in my office, we understand that 67% of ELL children are under the fifth grade. So they're very young children, is my understanding, which to me speaks to the need to help districts really understand, train teachers, understand how we support their effort to serve these children in elementary school. And one of the challenges that I pose to the districts and the department is, if we have a kindergartner that will come to a well-supported system, does that child need to stay for 7 years, which has been the question of, you know, funding for 7 years? I think overwhelmingly the answer has been no. But there are other children, and there is a very small percentage, who may need longer time and kind of different approaches. Understanding who these children are and how we support the districts in serving those children is absolutely critical. So I would like to know kind of what kind of analysis have you done in terms of populations and how we serve them and how we hear from the different districts about what they need. So if you could speak to that, that would be great.
Wonderful. And one last thought has to do with the efficacy of the WIDA-based tools. So with that, Senator, we're actually running very well on time now. Of course, we don't have the answers, but we'll catch up. With that, I'll transition to you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. So I'd like to call representatives of the University of Minnesota, who we have met with, I think, Mr. Chair and I. You've been present at some of the conversations, meetings we've had with the faculty from the University of Minnesota, very impressed with the work that they've done. So we decided to invite them to present some of that work and their experiences. So we have, I believe, three representatives from the university. I don't know if we have more, but I am going to
Senator, I'll give you a signal when we reach the point, but we're looking at about 20 minutes for both parts of this presentation. 20 minutes total, that is.
Okay. So, Professor Rainey, very welcome to our committee. We're very excited that you're here, and I'm going to ask you to start your presentation and then make sure that all of you please introduce yourselves and let us know what department you represent at the university. Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting us. We're delighted to be here. I'm Susan Rani in Second Languages and Cultures Education, working in preparing our teachers for world languages and ESL instruction. And I have my colleagues here in Second Languages and Cultures Education.
Diane Tedek, and I also work with teacher preparation for ESL and world language and dual language and immersion education.
My name is Dr. Martha Bigelow, and I focus on ESL instruction and specifically related to refugees.
I'm Dr. Jill Watson. I'm a specialized researcher in the needs of students who are English learners and also who have had limited or no prior education before coming to Minnesota schools.
So we have actually two presentations here. We're going to talk first about preparing teachers for working with English learners, and then Martha and Jill are going to talk specifically about the SLIFE students, the students with limited formal education. And Professor Tedek is an expert in immersion education, so she's going to help us with that. We want to share with you our vision for language education at in Minnesota, and we'll talk a little bit about our programs and courses, and talk about outcomes just by giving you a few examples of some of our graduates, and also we want to just share some concerns that we hear from the field. Our motto at the University of Minnesota is that we're preparing teachers to change the world. We want to work on equity and educational opportunity. We're concerned about economic competitiveness for Minnesota, which we believe involves promoting multilingualism and preparing people for the knowledge economy. I want to stop just a minute and talk about the word multilingualism, because I had a conversation with my in-laws over the weekend, and their concept when I said multilingualism was that, oh, well, then people wouldn't have to learn English. That's absolutely not what we mean by multilingualism or bilingualism. We want everyone to learn English. That's our focus, is on making sure everyone has access to learn English to a very high level. But we also know that it's important to promote other languages as well, in addition to English. So because if you think about the type of workforce that's going to help Minnesota in the 21st century, employers want workers who are able to communicate effectively in speech and writing about complex and abstract concepts. You need a high level of English in order to do that. They also want workers who are able to communicate with speakers of other languages across the world. So we need multilingual people. Equity for English learners means meaningful access to the full academic curriculum. So we want our English learners to learn math, science, social studies, and all the rest. They also need focused instruction on English, especially academic English. And whenever possible, they should have programs that support continued development of their native languages. Again, not because they're not going to learn English, but because learning, continuing to develop in their native language is going to help them in learning English and is going to help them in learning the other content areas. Another term I want to clarify is academic language, because there's some confusion about that too. According to Jeff Zweers, an expert in this, his definition is that academic language is the set of words, grammar, and organizational strategies used to describe complex ideas, higher-order thinking processes, and abstract concepts. So it's not just a few fancy words. It's not just technical terms. It's a lot of language, and it has the purpose of communicating abstract concepts. So if we want people to be able to do that kind of communication in our workforce, we need to work on their academic language. I brought in an example that I saw recently in an eighth-grade science class that I was visiting. The students had a lesson on plate tectonics, and then they were given a little quiz to see what they got out of it. And so this is a question about earthquakes and volcanoes. They occur due to, and then you have those choices. They're all pretty abstract concepts, the way they're worded. And actually, the students did not do well on this particular question. And this was a class that was mixed of native speakers of English as well as English learners. And when I look at that, I think, well, it's probably because of the academic language in the question itself. These are things that we don't use so much in normal conversation, in everyday conversation. If my husband asked me over the dinner table, you seem kind of irritated today, what's going on? I probably wouldn't respond by saying something like, my irritation occurred due to an unpleasant traffic experience, due to the winter weather that's wreaking havoc on our highways. This is not the kind of language that we use in everyday conversations. And that explains why our English learners may seem very fluent in English. Maybe they've picked up a lot of language. They don't even have an accent. But they may not be able to use academic language. And that's why they need extended time in terms of language support, and they need support, explicit instruction in this area. So what kind of teachers are needed? I'm going to let Dean take a slide.
We certainly need more language teachers, both world language and English as a second language teachers. This is certainly a need in our state. We need more immersion teachers for our growing number of two-way or dual immersion programs. These are both content and language teachers. They don't do one or the other. They do both. And then we also need our regular content teachers, our classroom teachers at the elementary level, and our secondary subject matter teachers to be committed to teaching all learners, to have the skills to reach English learners, and to support academic language development for all learners, including native English speakers.
Thanks. So our ESL teachers need to understand standards, as Lee Slesher was talking about, and how to reach students with different cultural and linguistic backgrounds and embed language instruction in their in content, and how to assess language proficiency. At the University of Minnesota, when we train people for ESL, they get expertise in English language, especially academic language and how people learn languages and so on, as well as all the pedagogy that other K-12 teachers learn. We have an initial licensure program, which we call the post-bac program. It's a year-long program at the master's level. We integrate the courses in student teaching. Students can do two licenses through our program. So many of them do ESL and a world language such as Spanish. And we have worked on innovating our programs through our redesign called Terry. For example, we work closely with partner districts and try to use co-teaching in our student teaching. We have courses for elementary education candidates and for content area candidates such as math, science, arts, social studies, and English. And in these courses, they learn to identify the academic language in their content area. They learn about how people learn languages. They do various projects to help them relate to English learners and to adjust their instruction. And then we also prepare immersion teachers.
We understand that immersion teachers are required to have a regular elementary ed license, but it doesn't really prepare them well for the immersion context. So we have a 15-credit graduate-level certificate program in dual language and immersion education for practicing teachers, and we're in the process of developing a proposal to present to the Board of Teaching for an alternative or non-conventional pathway to initial licensure in elementary with a focus on immersion.
So what can our teachers do? I want to just quickly share some of our outcomes. Karina is a graduate who is a Mexican immigrant. She's now teaching third grade ESL in Minneapolis in a school where 95% of the population speaks Spanish. And she said she's able to communicate with the parents and inform them of their children's progress in English. And also she's a wonderful role model for those students. Julie is a teacher in Rochester. She taught 6th to 8th graders for many years, and now she's working in the district. And some of her work is in helping general education teachers embed academic language and culturally relevant instruction into their lessons and assessments. Leah, I love this. She's with her grandfather there in her classroom. She's actually a graduate of dual immersion schools in Minneapolis and then eventually came through our program and did Spanish and ESL. And now she's the lead ESL teacher who's doing both ESL and Spanish immersion in a middle school in Minneapolis. And she said both of these programs deal with rigorous academic language acquisition. And having the dual immersion lends a certain prestige to language learning, and she approaches her ESL classes in the same way. They talk about learning academic English. And she finds that the blend of the IB program, dual immersion, and ESL encourages students to be inquiring and global-minded learners. Shannon, she's on the right there with her Earth Club that she leads at high school in St. Paul. She teaches Spanish and Japanese. And she said her message to students is that they can also be global communicators through trial, error, and effort. And she teaches in an urban school with a huge EL population and recommends that all licenses also be required to meet the needs of English learners. So in order to best support English learners. We want to maximize the use of ESL teacher expertise, promote a culture of school-wide responsibility for English learners. We need to share best practices with in-service as well as pre-service teachers and promote effective collaboration between ESL and classroom teachers. Some concerns we've heard from ESL teachers are that their roles are changing and may their roles actually in the way that they're asked to perform or have nothing to do with their training as language specialists, and sometimes their students are not getting the ESL instruction that they need. Sometimes with the reading interventions, they may not be well designed for ESL teachers, and they're not preparing ELs to be career and college ready. Or there are also problems with decisions about levels, how to determine what level and what kind of service students receive, and also a lack of professional development for the whole school. So we feel that there need to be, for better English learner education, that we need targeted training for the school leadership in research and practices for English learners and appropriate instructional models. We need ongoing professional development for all teachers. And where possible, we think an increase of dual immersion programs would also be helpful. And I have some other slides from the Carla Institute, but I'm going to move on to our colleagues now.
Thank you so much for inviting us to come. We are delighted to be able to talk with you about a subset of English learners. And this will serve as a way to illustrate how all English learners are not the same. We're also here to speak as researchers, and we're very proud that Minnesota is seen nationwide and also worldwide as a leader in terms of people that are producing research about learners with interrupted or limited formal schooling. Have to say, New York State has us beat in terms of the policy realm, but we are definitely viewed as people who are producing the most knowledge nationwide related to this population. So students, English learners with limited or interrupted formal education are known as SIF or SLIFE, so you get a new acronym. Some of you get a new acronym today. These are students that are coming without prior schooling, probably without a lot of print literacy in their home languages. They're coming without having ever been in formal education settings. This does not mean that they are empty vessels, that they don't come with assets, incredible resilience. They have a lot of skills that they bring to the educational enterprise, but many of those are not typically valued in school settings. Where do they come from? Lots of different places. We have many from East Africa, Burmese, Hmong, Bhutanese, Iraqi, Liberian. A lot of times we think about refugees as being the students with limited or interrupted formal schooling, but we also have a lot of Latinos who have led lives of migration who also we would identify as SLIFE students because of having missed so much formal schooling. So we know that they have had little or no opportunity to go to school where they've come from. They've been in refugee camps, or they've been in places that in countries that are not allowing them to go to school, like, for instance, Malta. They have little or no literacy in any language. Oftentimes they come with health and trauma issues. And we see these issues as impacting K-12 learners from kindergarten through 12th grade and beyond. But Dr. Watson and I are going to mainly focus on secondary learners in our talk with you today because their needs are so much more pronounced because they have fewer years to catch up and make it toward to graduation. One of our biggest problems in Minnesota is that we don't know how many SLIF students we have. Data are not collected in any way systematically, very, very uneven. Schools often have native language literacy screening devices or a questionnaire to try to get at who their students are that have limited or interrupted formal schooling, but this is very, very spotty. We can estimate, we're estimating that there are probably between 15 and 25,000 SLIF in Minnesota schools. But just for example, in Minnesota, we know that there's 14,000 Asian Pacific Islanders, okay? Many of those students have refugee backgrounds. For instance, Khmer speakers, Karen or Kareni speakers, Bhutanese kids. And so just for instance, kids with refugee experience backgrounds in St. Paul Public Schools alone, there's probably around 6,000. Maybe throughout all of Minnesota of the Asian Pacific Islander category kids, there's maybe 10,000 kids with interrupted or limited formal schooling. And so if you think about East Africans, we would probably double that. So there are a lot of kids that are kind of flying under the radar in terms of being identified. And then you add in Latinos as well that have often interrupted formal schooling. So there's a lot of this impacts a lot of our kids.
What I'd like to talk about is some specific learning challenges that this class of student faces in Minnesota schools. And in general, it's important to note that there is variability in how districts and schools address the needs of students with limited formal schooling. But as researchers, we've been able to observe some trends in the challenges that these students face in schools, and I'd like to share with those with you now. They fall under a general category, as Dr. Bigelow pointed out, of failure to identify and address in a systematic way the language and academic learning needs of SLIF students. One of the areas in which we see this most starkly is in inappropriate initial placement. And I'd like to just share with you this scenario. Two students arrive age 17. One of them has been in school all along for his age. He knows how to do advanced algebra and geometry. He's able to create a podcast and embed it within a Prezi, and he's ready to go. He just needs to learn English. The other student is 17 years old, and he needs support that's respectful and appropriate to learn how to hold a writing instrument, to learn that writing goes from left to right and should be done on the line, to learn which side of the paper has the holes in it and which side we start writing on, to learn the alphabet, what the letters sound like, what the numbers are, how to do basic addition and subtraction. And as you can see, all the skills that students who have had significant prior schooling, including many or most of us, have learned since pre-kindergarten and kindergarten and through all the grades. Both of these students are 17 years old, and both of them, according to the WIDA measure that our colleagues from MDE described, would test as having zero English proficiency. So both of them are going to be placed in a level one class. Now, I see some of you are registering that this is an issue that definitely calls for customized instruction. So inappropriate intake is occurring, sadly, in many schools where the questions about prior schooling aren't asked. And then a learning path that meets the needs of those two different kinds of students has not been laid out. That's one thing that we would like to call attention to. Another is once it's realized by typically the English language teacher and others in the school that one student hasn't had prior education and others have, there's an attempt to customize. But what we notice is that very often research-based effective learning practices are not used with SLIF students. In fact, it's not widely known what appropriate instruction is for SLIF students. This is not only a Minnesota problem, believe me. It's a U.S. problem, and it's a worldwide problem in every country that receives refugee students. Another issue that we'd like to draw your attention to is that many schools are inappropriately advancing students from a level one, say, to a level two, even though the learning gains have not been made, based more on seat time or time in the school or time in country rather than on learning gains. And that is, you know, a very big issue, as you can imagine, in high school, where the disparity between having very low basic skills and needing to accomplish tasks in a high school curriculum is a very, very wide disparity. There's one story I'd like to share briefly from a teacher here in Minnesota who shared a typical situation for a SLIFE student in a high school. She writes that, I have students who are in 11th grade. They had no schooling before coming to the U.S. They've been here 2 years. Now they're in their third year. They spent the first 2 years having intense English instruction along with other level ones and twos. Our administration wants to give the appearance of rigorous high expectations for them. So this year their schedules look like this: American literature, biology, chemistry, intro to engineering, human geography, world history, and geometry. I wish I could say that I was exaggerating on this, but sadly I am not. They are being thrown in way over their heads with very little support and are just going through the motions in these classes without retaining much of what they are taught. They are getting C's and D's because their teachers are under immense pressure to pass everyone. The end result with this horrible model is that we are going to push all of these students through in 4 years, and they will graduate and still only be able to read at a third grade level and not be able to get into community college or to get a job requiring literacy.
Limit on time. So yes. Just if you need to say a few remarks to finish your presentation.
Certainly.
Let's get to our solutions. We have some ideas.
Yes. We'll have them back. We would like to suggest specific policy goals in two areas. We would like to request and propose that we sharpen focus on students' English development and promote academic language according to the amount of time that students need, not according to what we wish they would be able to accomplish, but their realistic needs, and increase teacher and administrator understanding of SLIFE needs, that particular subgroup that has little prior education, if any. To reach those goals, we need these specific things. These are our suggestion points: a culture of school-wide responsibility for SLIFE, better intake data collection and sharing down the line, including making schedules and long-term reporting and monitoring, targeted training for school leadership so they know what to look for in appropriate SLIFE instruction, strong ongoing professional development for all teachers, including who teach mainstream and content areas, in the specific needs of these students, customized research-based instruction for SLIFE, which is not the same as appropriate instruction for English learners in general, and we strongly advocate extending the four-year graduation time and age-out limit so that students who are not getting their high school diploma and depressing the graduation rate within a year or two extra time would be able to increase the graduation rate. Avoid premature mainstreaming. Avoid seat time promotion. Evaluate teachers for their effectiveness and their administrators for their effectiveness in supporting best practice for SLIFE. And collect the data about who has been to school before and who has not. We would also suggest Minnesota Department of Education work with the U and other bodies and teachers and districts to come up with guidelines for our state for working with SLIFE as New York State has. And I would just say to you all, legislators and public present, in our view, every legislator and citizen should be able to ask a district what they are doing to customize instruction for limited formal schooling English learners and get a strong research-based answer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us today.
And I think this format that suggested by Representative Mariani is very good. I see that the department left to figure out the answers for you members. maybe that is a good thing. So they're deliberating how to answer. So that gives them a little time. So members, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Senator. I think my question is better answered by the first half of the panel than the emphasis on SLIFE. But maybe to illustrate, if I may, Madam Chair, a brief story from our district. I was at a public event a couple of years ago with the superintendent, and it was an open meeting for parents to engage the superintendent. And it was held in a middle school that I believe at the time was the only middle school in the state that required Arabic of all of its students. So it was the only world language that they offered. Everybody was expected to take Arabic. And a mother got up. Her daughter had actually graduated from that middle school and gone on to high school. in Minneapolis. Mom was a Latina. Obviously, the daughter then was as well. Mom actually used the translator that the school district provided because Mom's English was limited. And she had a complaint. Her daughter spoke English. Her daughter spoke Spanish. Her daughter had taken Arabic in middle school, had gone on to high school, but now she had to take Chinese. And so Mom's problem was the girl was going to end up graduating, if she stayed on track, with speaking fluently or at least somewhat four different languages. I thought that was a good problem to have. And I think that's, particularly for the first half of the panel, that's my question. We tend to position English language learners as cost drivers, challenges to good graduation rates, cultural challenges and the like. How do we instead look at these children as assets? Because the the opportunity that a child growing up speaking Arabic at home or in their faith community offers to business, offers to government, offers to the military is huge. But we position them as a problem and a drag and a cost. Can particularly the first half of the panel. If the second half wants in on it, that's up to the senator. But
thank you. And Representative Davney, one thing that we agreed to do is that they're going to take the questions, and then they're going to come back at the end, and they are going to respond. So we're just going to ask the
thank
questions, and they
my
will respond.
Great question.
I think we had Senator Nino and Representative Geruso. Please go ahead.
Page 6, the first slide there, to reach the goals we need, and you have some bullet points. One of those was avoid seat time promotion, which is the example that was given towards the end there. I'd like to hear more about that, suggestions, recommendations. How do we avoid the seat time promotion?
Okay. And Representative Geruso and then Representative Briner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the group of students called SLIFE students, there's an extremely wide range between the two extreme examples that you gave us, and I'm wondering if there's anybody who has a database that would help districts avoid reinventing the wheel every time they have a student land in their district, because there can be some very significant differences in the sequencing of curriculum among the educational programs of different countries and particularly different language groups of countries because they've inherited the systems from other places. So it would be useful if it doesn't exist or does it? Is somebody already working to provide that kind of information?
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You noted in your presentation that the acronym SLIFE might be new to us. So, and then you proceeded to challenge us to a series of policy goals along with specific items that we points of achievement we'd need to get to those goals. So I'd like to ask you for a much more specific sense of the timeline and the incremental steps necessary, given the fact that you're talking to policymakers who are very unfamiliar with the depth and breadth of the research base for the subject matter you put on the table.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be a little more interested in hearing also about the pool of teachers that we are trying to recruit and the difficulties that we are finding in making sure that we have good folks in front of a great demand for ESL, ELL teachers. So some of the barriers maybe that we're seeing in that regard.
Got it. Senator Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to piggyback on that question from Senator Dahl, I'm impressed with the level of resources we have at the University of Minnesota, and I commend you for the research that you've done to date. I'd like to hear more about what the need is. If you had the magic wand to say we need 50 ESL teachers to meet the need, Have you done research on what the need for Minnesota is, given the changes that we've seen in the last decade or so and where the populations are growing? And are you suggesting that we need to add ESL teachers? We need to have an incentive for teachers to go and get that certification from the U of M or get those certificates and higher learnings to be able to meet those demands.
Thank you. Senator Nelson?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate coming with the data that you brought and also the recommendations. That's really, I think, what we need to see, that those recommendations based upon the data of the current situation. I noticed a couple times that the presenters talked about customized instruction. And that kind of goes back to my earlier question. I'd like to know if we have any data about what particularly works with that customized instruction. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Well, thank you very much. I have been just incredibly impressed as some of the, we've met a couple of times now, and just very proud to have this institution really working on these issues, the faculty before us, really helping us figure out what are the answers. And Representative Mariani and I and the members are very committed to figuring out really what is the kind of system that we need to have in place to respond to all of the needs. And like Representative Mariani said at the beginning, you know, this is kind of a population that we know we need to attend to because it's fast-growing. We know that there are some challenges as well as some very incredible opportunities that they bring to the state. So we intend to really give some attention and count on your support and your expertise to do better and to serve these children in the best possible way. So thank you for being here.
So I'll take over the next part of the agenda here, and I have the either the privilege or I'm going to get in trouble because I get to call up my superintendent from my the school district that I represent in my district, the St. Paul Schools. And it's always a deep privilege and honor for me to interact with Superintendent Silva and her staff. So I look forward to your testimony. And again, the reminder is that we'll hear your testimony. We'll take questions. We won't answer the questions immediately, and then we'll have everyone back up. And so it'll give you some time to mull over the questions that come at you. So we're going to have about 10 to 15 minutes and no more because I'm going to need to keep us moving, and that's where I am going to get in trouble with my superintendent, no doubt, but perhaps not. So welcome. Good afternoon. Good to see you, Superintendent.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure who is, if you're the chair of the
committee. We're both chairing.
Okay.
Dr. Silva, we're both chairing. So welcome.
So welcome, thank you for having us here. We'll talk really fast, and we will get a lot of information out there. I think the way you put the presentations are perfect because I don't have to explain to you what is an ELL student. You got really good information. I appreciate the thought. Fullness on that. So I'll start with some of our data, who we are as a district, because we are the district that has the most ELL students in the state of Minnesota. The services that we offer, we have two principals that they'll tell you the story, and then we will have more information if you need, and we can have some questions. And just as a glance, we got 39,000 students, and you can all read 12%. 12,000 of them are ELL students. We have 85 schools and programs, and 46% of our total population of the 39,000 students, it's ELL. And then we have over 100 languages. We are probably one of the most diverse school districts in the country because of the number of languages and the concentration. As you heard before, there's a concentration on several languages, and it's Hmong, Spanish, Korean, Somali, Vietnamese, and Oromo. And I'm not sure you can see it, but definitely the Hmong is 44%, the Spanish is 22%, Korean is 15%, Somali is 7%, and the others is about 8%. So when people say, well, why can't we teach them in their native language? Which language do you want me to find to teach them? Because we have students who are trilingual already. So and we have seen the most growth is 264% within the last 5 years with our Korean Burmese students, they are speaking Korean, and it took us almost a year to find certified translators, and they are absolutely blossoming in our schools. As you can see, our enrollment of ELL students level 1, which are the newcomers, it's continually growing in St. Paul. In 209, we have a large percentage of our, or no, sorry, 207, we have a lot of Hmong students, and now we continue to have diverse groups that are coming to our district. What I wanted to point out here is that majority of our students who are level 1 are new to our system every year. It's like 800 of new level 1 students, and the rest are the students who have been staying with us for more than a year, so on and so forth. Here is just the visualization of what it would look like by levels. As you see, our students who are newly enrolled, the ones who are new to the district, most of them are level 1. And then it's the level 5 students. So then when we talk about new enrollment, those are the kids we receive in our schools from the native country to St. Paul, Minnesota, into our schools. And you also had that divided by grade levels. And the blue are the elementary grade levels, 1 to 5. The red is the middle schools. And the green is the high schools. And I wanted to put it this way because I want you to understand that our kids as a level 1 come from elementary to middle school to high school. And people have this conception that you only get kind of little kids, and that's what they should be fluent when they get to high school. So next, this gives you a picture as a system, not just the newcomers, but everybody who stays in our school district. We have the majority of our kids are level 3 and level 4. And as you see, there's it's always a little bit more elementary students than high school students, but it's still a significant number. When you look at 1,348 kids that they are in those levels, is a number in which it requires us to provide additional services for our students. And yes, we are absolutely blessed by having ELL students in our district. And I tell you, believe it or not, 1996, when I became the ELL director, we started the campaign about the fact that our kids were an asset to the organization. And I believe St. Paul Public Schools, absolutely, the staff see our ELL students as an asset and how they will be able to do in the future. Across the grade levels, just for you to see how we have the concentration from the kindergarten, usually is a little bit higher, all the way to the 12th grade. You see a little bit of a higher levels on the 9th grade, because when we have students coming to us as adults after 16, we put them in grade level 9, because then they enter a high school, a traditional high school, or LEAP, for example, as one of our schools, but they enter as a 9th grader, and then they have the time to grow to the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade with the credits that they need in order to be successful. So let me tell you a little bit about our services. We began our work by welcoming this families in the placement center. We do have interpreters and materials in different languages. We have done videos. We have done tapes and CDs for them to take home about what do we have in St. Paul Public School for them. We translate most of the most important materials in 7 different languages. And the student arrive, we give them this test, which is something that you heard before, that non-placing the students in the right place is an issue. And then we really have taken that to the core of the issue. We go and test students at the placement center instead of in each school, because then we have a consistent test with the consistent people who are applying the tests. We have not only the students doing the speaking and listening, but we also try to do the reading and writing. And in many cases, we have been able to even identify the level of fluency in their native language if we have materials available. And then we designated them as level 1 to 6, and then we placed them in different programs. So we have expanded our pre-K access to our students in ELL. We have this last year, since 2010, we have 20% more seats for ELL for our students. And remember, this is pay out of the referendum. So we've been much ahead of the curve about early interventions than many districts, and we have been able to do that due to the referendum dollars or levy. We prioritize in our four-year-old program students who are ELL, free reduced lunch, and special education. So then, because they're going to have the most struggles when they get to the kindergarten. We have seen that 90% of our students who are in pre-K stay in our district. And this is amazing. 85% of them, they target the alphabet knowledge that we require for students to go into kindergarten. So that is a very successful program. I welcome anybody to visit. It's unbelievable. And we also, once the students become first graders, we place the students in language academies. We have 9 elementary schools, there are language academies, 5 middle schools, and 5 high schools. And we also have a dual language immersion program. We have the Hmong, Spanish, and Chinese, and French. And we have the co-teaching model. We have adopted that since 1998. And then the teacher and the classroom teacher is also learning how to do strategies for second language learners by watching how the ELL teacher works with them. And it's been very successful, and there are many, many students and many teachers that will say, I don't know how to teach alone anymore. So with that, I'm going to give it to Catherine to start her presentation.
And I'm going to be the bad person here and weigh in, because we do have other folks I want to get to. And so I'm going to ask you to not do your full presentation. Just sort of get right to a main point that you'd like to make. We'll have you back up, and so we'll have some question and answer, and that might be an opportunity to fold in. I'm looking ahead to your slides. Some very impressive information about results that's occurring, particularly looking at the Phelan Lake School. But again, I do want to keep us moving, and I do want to get some questions out quickly for you. So if you can just take a minute or two, and then we'll keep pushing forward.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chairs, as I said, I'm Catherine Rich, principal at Phelan Lake Hmong Studies Magnet. And fast forward, it's an extraordinary school that I would invite you to visit at any time to take a look at our Language Academy learners in action in the classroom. To start with our achievements and the work that we've begun, in 2010 we had 11% gain on MCAs with 54% of our children proficient, and in 2012 again a 10% gain with 48% of our students proficient in reading. This past year we moved from a focus school to a celebration eligible, which is moving up 2 designations. And our journey has been very intentional, and it's been very specific. When I talk about the instructional emphasis that we look at, we got to be quite specific about what we needed to do, what did we know our students, and what worked best. Quickly to go through as it's gone on the page, I'd like you to meet Sir Clue. He's a fifth grade student. This is a photo of Sir Clue from Friday in math. He is his second year in the country. He came to us last October. He's progressed from no English skills to an adaptive grade-level work in 1.3 years. Just to be able to take a look at one of the strategies, which is an integrated approach to what we're doing in our learning, Sir Clue is leading a math review lesson. He was in front of his peers in a general ed classroom on Friday. He is demonstrating how to use mathematical strategies to solve three different problems the class has worked through. If you were to look down in the corner, you see the adult on the floor by the projector. Is the classroom teacher there to provide prompts if needed? But Sir Clue is able to successfully, in English, articulate the strategies he's used to solve the problem. We do a collaboration with our ELL teacher and classroom teacher to deliver lessons. This is a literacy lesson. They are working on a grade-level text novel. They're doing large group sharing, small group breakout sessions, designed specifically to have our students be able, as you heard earlier, the need for academic language, to address specific ways of questioning and how to acquire academic language in their small group conversations. The next sort of wraparound layer that we have for our students is we have, in this particular classroom, a bilingual Karen teaching assistant who works collaboratively again with the teacher. While she is teaching in English, he is doing a simultaneous translation in Karen and then providing the students the same concepts in English so that they're able to access in both her home language as well as English of the classroom. We also have a wraparound kind of service, which is the parent-principal forum connections. If you could see in this photo, these are our families that came in with an opportunity to engage in technology in the classroom. We have bilingual staff that support families that have access. They come to school. We provide connections to the community. And we also provide multilingual translations to go home for schools. So.
Well done, Principal Rich. Mr. McCullough, you're going to have Mr. even McCullough. Less time, I'm afraid. But please, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Senators, Representatives. I just want to highlight three strategies we use at Washington. First of all, welcome to our attendance area. We're now in the Washington Technology Magnet attendance area right here at the Capitol. We have about 2,000 students. About 1,000 of them are second language learners, so about 1,000 ELL students at Washington, most of any school in the state of Minnesota. And I want to highlight three strategies for you. We start talking about, this is an issue. We need to get these kids to higher levels of performance. The first one is co-teaching. So that's the partnership or combination of an ELL teacher, but also a content teacher. If you want the student to be learning high school level biology or science, chemistry, social studies, you need to have that content expertise as well as the ELL teacher with those language strategies for the students. The other piece is a support class that we offer. So, for example, in the biology class, they would co-teach the biology class, but then the ELL teacher would have an additional amount of time with the students in an ELL support class. And then a part of that is our extended day program. Again, Washington has extended day for every student every day from the first day of school to the last day of school. The biggest thing second language learners need is more time. They come here. They're a tremendous advantage to the state and to our society. They really want to learn. They get the American dream, but we need to give them the time and the strategies in order to help them be successful. I won't bore you with the list of our accomplishments on the last page, but you can read those at your leisure.
Principal McCullough, they're wonderful accomplishments. Thank you for your work. Thank you all for your testimony. Again, we'll do round robin to see questions, and then hopefully you can stay.
Can I just point out the graduation up? Because someone mentioned graduation. Look at the 2012. That's the latest. We know that our graduation rate, which is going to be given away tomorrow, and it's much higher than 65% for ELLs. And we are really on top of this compared to other school districts, and between 18 to 20 points ahead of the state itself. And remember, we pushed the state up because we have the most ELL students. And I'm really proud of the work the district has done and our staff committing to the most important part is all kids must learn. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Superintendent. My quick question has to do with picking out, and Principal McCullough, thank you for the three strategies component. Principal Rich actually also spoke about this, but you laid them out all very concisely for us, very helpful. I want to zero in very quickly when you come back just on pre-K and the importance of pre-K relative to issues that we face with EL students, but also how that overlaps into multilingual capacity goals that I think Representative Dabney illustrated powerfully for us. as a as an enriching important goal for us to have, and why pre-K as a focus. Members, questions? Senator Nelson.
That's okay. Thank you, Chair Mariani. I have a question regarding if you have any data about the customized learning that you're using with your ELL students, and I applaud the graduation rate that you have there, that it exceeds that state average. I've visited with some of your teachers. I think you're using Imagine Learning with your ELL kids, and I would very much like to see the data on that, if you have that.
I do, but I would have to send it to you.
That'd be great. Yes. But just to see, you know, has that made a
pretty
difference?
Good. It,
that was my understanding.
For newcomers, that's excellent.
I'd like to see that. Thank you.
Members? Senator Franson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I'm curious if one of your strategies, so you're talking about the extended day and you're adding an hour a day for academic support, enrichment, or fitness. I represent a district that's less diverse, and I'm still hearing that they want more time as well for learning. So if you can elaborate, are we talking about the same time because we want kids to catch up or do better, or that extended time? Is it needed across the board or just for English language learners?
I would say
And Superintendent, we'll answer the questions when we when have
you
a,
do.
Come back.
We'll
others?
Come back.
Oh, that's true. With that,
yes, we'll come back. Others? Senator Wicklund.
Yeah, I have a question. I'd be interested in knowing what your thoughts are about our current assessments that you use. Ooh. Are they serving EL students well? Are they serving your needs well? And the amount of assessments required, is that helping our EL students? Just kind of your feedback on how you use them today and how well they're working.
Very well, members. So we're going to move on. And Senator, I'm going to pass the baton back over to you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And, you know, for the audience and the members, I think what I hope is clear, what we're trying to do is kind of learn from best practices, learn from research, learn from the different districts about, you know, what is working, what is not working. And hopefully all of those components will be coming together with your help to be part of the legislation that we move forward. And so as we attempt to just kind of put our arms around key elements, we encourage you to, if those issues were not addressed today or were not, you know, were incomplete, please get in touch with either Representative Mariani or myself to make sure that we do have another presentation or we do ask districts or people who are working on these issues. So next we have Bloomington, and I understand, Senator Wicklund, that there are so many exciting things happening in Bloomington. So we decided that it was really important to have this suburban perspective that we typically don't have. We're going to move into later on talking about rural perspectives as well. But we think that the volume of students that is really now moving into suburban communities is really outstanding in Minnesota. So you have been identified as a district who is really working hard to adopt best practices and to be innovative. So we were looking forward to hear your presentation. Welcome. Please go ahead and introduce yourselves before you start your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Melby, the Executive Director of Student Services with the Bloomington Public Schools, and I brought two friends with me to help with this presentation. I'll have them introduce themselves.
I'm Beth Stingline. I'm the EL Supervisor for Bloomington.
And I'm Andy Kubas. I'm the Principal at Valley View Elementary School in Bloomington.
We are happy to be here to share what we're doing in Bloomington with you all. Part of our mission in Bloomington is to be an educational leader, and coming to something like this to share what we're doing with our program is a way for us to share that leadership with everybody who's listening today. We're going to talk a little bit about our program. We're going to focus on some of our early childhood efforts and family connection and engagement efforts, and then we'll be happy to get some questions at the end. I'm going to talk first a little bit about our own population in Bloomington. As you mentioned, Senator, the kind of suburban districts having more and more influx of EL learners. Bloomington is certainly represents that. Over one of every five Bloomington Elementary School students is an EL student at this point. And I'm glad my data pretty much matches up with what MDE was showing earlier. This is just an example that Bloomington's multiple languages challenge we sometimes have mirrors what the state is dealing with. We have a lot of Spanish speakers, but we also have a lot of other languages that we're and cultures that we're working with in Bloomington. And just another representation of that data would be that unlike some other states or districts, we don't have a focus purely on Spanish speakers. We have a lot of language diversity, and this slide shows that Minnesota is quite high, as was mentioned earlier by other presentations, in terms of language diversity. Mobility is also a large issue for our EL families and mm-hmm. for schools working with those students. We have a very high mobility rate, and some of the family engagement and early childhood initiatives we have going in Bloomington, we hope will help address mobility. It certainly won't address all of mobility, but if we make a good connection with families early, I believe they'll be more inclined to try to stay with the school or with the district. Just an example of that mobility challenge. This shows, if it's hard to see, the more kind of yellowish graph are for our continuously enrolled EL students in Bloomington on a CULT reading score. That means they're enrolled with us between grades 2 and 7 versus mobile EL students who come and go at least once between grades 2 and 7. As you can see, if they're continuously enrolled with us, they make great progress. If they're mobile, not as great of progress. Previous slides, our experience agrees with that, and it's been mentioned earlier, so I won't talk too much about it, but the long-term EL challenge, working with students who require more than 5 years of EL service, is an issue for us. Our middle schools, particularly in Bloomington, have a high percentage of long-term ELs that we're servicing. So our program, and this is where I'll probably defer a little bit to Beth on this, is when I came to Bloomington 4 years ago, we reached out to MSU Mankato and worked with their department to come and do a program audit, so to speak, of our program and give us recommendations on how we might improve and move forward with our program. Through that, we created a new mission statement, a program that includes much more team teaching, focus on academic and oral language to better meet the needs of long-term ELs. And I'm going to click through, Beth, and you can jump in, please.
Okay. Oh, you want me to jump in now?
Sure. we're new to testifying.
Yeah, so one of the things we did 5 years ago when we looked at our program is we tried to figure out how we could best meet the needs of everybody in a district that has a diversity of economics and a diversity of population at each school. For example, Valley View Elementary is 48% English language learners. There's a school on the west side that's about 2%. So how do you create a model that kind of honors both of those things? Andy has 7 EL teachers, and this school has a half-time teacher. So we really tried to look at the idea of collaboration. How do you work with the content teachers so that we're doing two things all day? We're meeting the language needs of the students, and we're meeting the academic content needs of the students. When I started in the district, we pulled kids out, and we worked on a lot of social language. We worked on the calendar. We worked on days of the week, and I'm exaggerating a little, but probably not too much. And so as we've had to kind of ramp things up, we've had to say, how do we work with the content teachers so that whether we're pulling the kids out or we're moving towards more team teaching, depending on the site and how much staffing we have, that we're always working on the academic language needs of the kids. And so we looked at the WIDA standards and we say, okay, so this is a lot of academic language, and how do we align that with our essential standards?
Thanks. There's a list of things here, but some of the things we're doing is focusing on those transitions between grades, between schools. We have some summer programs, and just real briefly, Beth, maybe you can talk about that summer program that we're doing with United Way.
Yeah, the United Way, one of the things we noticed about kids coming into our program or being in our program for more than 1 year is they lack a lot of background knowledge and vocabulary and oral language practice, meaning that we all kind of come to school with this kind of schemata in our head. So if we're going to start learning about castles, we should be able to connect it to something else that we've learned at home or talked about. And often EL kids come in without the same, I would say, common background that native English speakers come in. They have background. It's just in different things. So I think sometimes we assume, well, they know about this. If we're going to talk about baseball, I mean, that's a whole big conversation if you don't know anything about baseball. So you can't start reading a book about it if you don't know anything about it. Anyways, I'm talking too much. The summer school program, the idea was instead of sending kids to do more remedial reading and math is to give them experiences. Experiences that they can't always afford through community education. So we partnered with Community Education in the United Way, and we wrote a grant where English learners would, K-5, would work with a tutor for an hour, an English language tutor, most of them coming from the University of Minnesota, and they would build background for the kids, and they would build vocabulary. And then they would go and take a class about magic. But everything that they're doing is academic in nature, but they're having a great time. Or they go fishing. Or they go to the art center in Bloomington. And so we're going into our third year, and it's great. Our retention is 100%, and the kids are doing very well. So that's one thing. And, you know, we're probably going to be transitioning over to Andy here. The other thing is the transitions. We really are focusing this year on looking at the kids who are in their early childhood program, who are dual language learners, and how we can make sure that we're communicating with their families, with their teachers, so that when they start kindergarten, we are ready to go to help them with their language needs.
So in Bloomington, our strategic plan, our mission come to life is what we call Pathways to Graduation. And so we want every kid to be preschool ready, ready for kindergarten, as you can see as the chart goes up, third grade, middle school, college, and career ready. A lot of that ties together with what we're already being asked to do with World's Best Workforce legislation. We're feeling good about where we're at in Bloomington and how we can you know, work with that legislation. Part of that is early childhood and being ready for kindergarten. We have a program we call Kinder Prep. It's for four-year-olds. It's English learners. Could also be low-income kids, but it's really 100% English learners. Free to families, we provide transportation. We have it in six sites, including Mr. Kubis's school. There's a parental involvement component to that, and we believe it creates an early connection between schools and families. Oops, I went too far. But I'd like Andy just to briefly talk about that Kinder Prep program and how it works at Valley View Elementary.
Absolutely.
Could be very brief,
I will
appreciate that.
To Beth's point about background knowledge, I was in a classroom just before the winter break. The teacher was talking about animals being in the pen, you know, as a farm. I saw one of our English language learners pick up this and look at it, and if I could read inside her mind, she's thinking, how do animals fit inside this pen? But again, it's bringing different background to the conversation. So at Valley View, we have a four-year-old program, as Eric talked about, for our English learners. We think it helps us in a couple different ways, and I'll be concise. There are some hard skills. A lot of our learners who come, who are English language learners, don't have the hard skills that we know as academia that we want to make sure that they get exposed to. I think more importantly, and it's not maybe something I could put a number to, is we really appreciate what happens with the Kinder Prep model with the soft skills. How do you play school? You know, how are you indoctrinated into the school culture, not only for kids, but for the families as well? So we strategically engage our families in the Kinder Prep model. We do a curriculum that engages the families to show that they are asset-based, not that, you know, as was bantered about before. They're not a detriment to our culture here. They're asset-based. And I think, you know, as a little bit of an editorial, oftentimes where we've gone wrong in education is that we have brought families in to say, let us teach you how to be great parents. They're already great parents. Let us use what you already have and engage you in those conversations and then take your culture. Then you'll be a better partner. We'll have a better authentic relationship if we can engage you that way. And our Kinder Prep program does that.
Family engagement, as Andy just mentioned, is very important. So through Kinder Prep, we have a lot of parental engagement opportunities. We also have what we call family academies in Bloomington. We have a fairly new program started last year with Family Stars University to district-wide families. We have cultural liaisons through our Office of Educational Equity, family engagement coordinators who work in concert with those liaisons at various buildings in the district, obviously school social workers. We have a number of cultural parent groups that have formed and work through our Office of Educational Equity. And then, of course, there's schools doing their individual efforts. Finally, I'll wrap it up. From a Bloomington's perspective, we like to use research and data to help produce our results. Some of you have sat on other committees, probably have seen Dr. Dave Heisted come and talk. He works with the Bloomington schools and has produced what we call pathway slides. Each student, each family has an opportunity to see where their student is on a pathway to graduation, and they can kind of gauge that, whether their goals are to go to, in this case, Carleton or Normandale or whatever the case may be, aspirationally for a family, for a kid. We can help them see what they need to do to get there. And this is an example of a Beat the Odds Hispanic male. Just one example of a student who obviously started with us below on course for a two-year college in grade two, and then, you know, through good instruction, through good EL service, is really beating the odds and is already in seventh grade on course for two-year college graduation and probably aiming even higher than that. And I point that out because we have that information available, and I call it Beat the Odds because we can track down that data in Bloomington. What's going on with that student? What classroom are they in? We can do the autopsy and the research to understand what's working and then try to replicate that around the district and other places, scale it up if necessary, if it's something that could be scaled up. And that information is available to teachers, administrators, and parents. We have an app for parents in Bloomington. They can go to their phone or their Android or whatever the case may be and see where their student is on that pathway and get more information from us if they want it. So
thank you. Thank you very much. And I've met with Dr. Heistad to talk a little bit about, you know, the data collection that you've put in place. I was very impressed with this information. I think Senator Wicklund will have a hearing. We will have a hearing to really talk about families that move around and what is happening in your campaign to keep families in Bloomington so that you can show the results, academic results, when families stay with your district. I'm very impressed with the family engagement as well. I think that has been very well received by many people around the state. I think that you're testing some very dynamic and innovative practices. Let's move to questions very quickly so that we can document that and move to the final part. Any questions for Bloomington? Members, you know, we will bring, when we dive into the conversation about this bill, we will have ample opportunity to review this in detail, too. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Senator. I'd like to hear, when you come back, I'd like to hear a little bit more about this Kinder Prep approach. In particular, I'm really interested in the integration of data and practices, you know, throughout the continuous pathway of your students. And it's something we don't hear often enough about. Perhaps it just isn't happening enough, but I suspect in public education is sort of a big frontier of work for us, which is how do we do that alignment with kindergarten and even early childhood relative to the rest of the pathway and how that early on informs what else can happen. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
Okay. Hey, members. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very specifically, I'm wondering how you fund your family engagement coordinators.
Okay. Representative Sawatsky, go ahead.
Madam Chair, to feedback off of that a little bit, a lot of our parents, I think, are very interested in working, and it's a real compromise also between if you're working the second shift or the third shift and then the day shift and when your children are available and all that. I'm interested a little bit in knowing how to get the parents that really need to be involved, how they do get involved in what, because I think that they really do generally, I mean, they do want to do well by their children, but I find that we don't always get the right folks there that need to be there, and how do you get that to be successful, and what model or what entices them to be able to participate?
Go to the last. Yes. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you have Dr. Heisted working for you, does Bloomington, does he also track or provide you with data to show how all of your students are progressing toward college and career goals? Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Don't go away. We'll be right back. With that, we're going to move to our last scheduled formal testimony, and this is from Janice Vasquez. And we're going to be focusing here on a conversation with one community representative of Greater Minnesota. Terrible thing to do because Greater Minnesota is an incredibly diverse part of our reality here, but we thought it was important to at least have one voice here in the Twin Cities, a very important voice, particularly given my understanding of the incredible growth of both challenges and opportunities for communities across our state relative to this population. So welcome to the committee, and please start by stating your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Janice Vasquez. I don't believe that after listening to all the presentations this afternoon that I will be saying anything new or earth-shattering that you haven't already heard, but I believe what I do have to say will give you an idea of our story out in Willmar. So again, my name is Janice, and I've been an ELL teacher in Willmar for the past 25 years. Willmar may be 2 hours from here, but we do have many similarities in the ELL arena with some distinctions. One way our district has changed over the years is that we have gone from a Latino, majority Latino population to serving many Somali families as well. And the Somali families that are coming to us have much more limited formal education than our Latinos did in the past, and so we are very challenged by trying to meet all of their needs. So to give you a better understanding, Willmar Public Schools has seen a consistent growth of English language learners since the mid-80s. When I was hired in 1988, I was the fourth EL teacher in the district. Today we have 25 K-12 ELL teachers serving over 800 students. This is 20% of our total student population. Of these, of these 800, there are approximately 52% who speak Spanish, 44% who speak Somali, and 4 are other languages, most recently the Burmese community that's been coming to Willmar to work with the Willmar Poultry Company. And so we're finding it challenging to find representatives from their community to help us with the communication between school and family. And so what's working well for us in Willmar? We feel that the need for more ELL teachers has been apparent, and so our district has stepped up to employ more ELL teachers to serve our increasing number of students so that we can effectively not just serve the numbers but also the varying proficiency levels that we have. And another important resource that has been just very valuable to us is the West Central Integration Collaborative, which is provided state integration funds. And so they have been providing for us integration programming, competency, cultural competency opportunities, and interpretation translation services so we can communicate more effectively with the families we serve. So they've been very important to us. Along with these positive steps towards student success, there still remain a number of concerns which are not always simple to amend. For example, the statistics I mentioned are easy numbers to comprehend, but until we look at the deeper picture, it may be not as telling. So the numbers really tell us about who the children really are and the types of backgrounds they come from. And it's not just language proficiency backgrounds that we're looking at. So, again, today what I've heard you're kind of going to hear again from me is the importance of first language literacy. And with that first language competence, English language progress usually takes off with leap and bounds. But without that, the students really struggle and it takes them longer to progress in English. So we also have to remember that parents and students come from us from a variety of backgrounds, and the students and families that we're really getting are the ones who are coming from impoverished and disadvantaged backgrounds because so many come from refugee camps. And some of them, again, as you've heard before, come to our districts maybe never holding a pencil. And so in order to go from that level, and you're already in middle school, to think about learning all the standards you need to in order to graduate, is just there's just such a huge gap. And so we need to remember that these students have very little, probably letter-to-sound correspondence. Many struggle with the concept of even one- and two-digit addition, you know, not to mention subtraction, multiplication, or other technical language that they're expected to learn quickly. And so along with this, the students who have never attended a structured educational institution before obviously need a lot of time to understand and maneuver within our system. Some of these same students come to us with trauma. You know, some of them will tell me about seeing a family member killed or tortured. I have one student who can remember, who's been here now for 3 years, when he was in about fifth grade when he came. At nighttime, his family would go outside with a torch trying to get the lions away from their huts. Wow. And so to think of the differences in backgrounds is just immeasurable sometimes. So you can see how learning language and learning our English system and culture is going to take a lot of time. So today what I would like you to consider is extending the funding for ELL students from 5 to at least 7 years, which I understand is on the table, but also to take a look at class size. Because class size, when we're talking about students who have very limited formal education, it's going to take them longer and they need more one-on-one support. I'd also like you to really think about that extra funding, because for those students who have that limited education, who can't make those leaps and bounds, that extra money will help us ensure that we can serve them to the best of our ability. So in addition, many of these same students, as we have heard again, are asked to take the reading MCA test at grade level. So this means a student, for example, who comes in at the middle school level, hardly being able to read, after 1 year has to take the reading test. You know, is disappointing, because I think schools need to be looking at, you know, really increasing their self-esteem instead of deflating it. So asking a student to take the reading MCA after a year is not advantageous for our students' growth. So if you could please consider reevaluating how and when students are expected to take the state assessments and adjusting probably their timeline so that they could not only make more gains on the state assessments but also on their day-to-day academics. Educating students, especially students whose first language is not English, has always been my dream job, and after 25 years, I'm very glad to still be in the same position. I'd love to see their success no matter how great or small. Though we need to remember, though, that not all students learn at the same rate. We have to remember that there are those who will not progress as quickly due to their lack of prior education and emotional experiences. So if we can remember how distinct our ELL learners are and provide for their emotional and academic well-being without extra hindrances such as inappropriate grade-level testing when they are at an academic and or proficiency level so below the test expectation, our students will succeed faster and feel English is much more attainable. So I want to thank you again for listening to my story and giving me the opportunity to advocate for English language learners all around the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Vasquez. And you're probably the person who's traveled. Well, no, I think we have a few members that might have traveled a little bit further, but thank you for traveling to be with us here today. Representative Sawatsky, I'm wondering if you might have a question. Actually, what I'm going to do is just keep you at the table, so we'll you're going to be a little bit at a disadvantage because you won't have time to think about your answers. We're just going to ask them right now,
okay.
And then we'll keep cycling through the others. But I'm just wondering if maybe you have a question or a comment you'd like to add, Representative Sawatsky.
Maybe a comment, Mr. Chair. I remember team teaching in a math class, and we had students. I like to tell a lot of stories, and so I had there was one student whose name is Ahmed, and he's a 15-year-old in that class as a in the middle school, so he was an eighth grader. And I said, well, I was trying to explain a situation, and I said, well, think back when you were in kindergarten. And right away he says, oh, that's easy, that was last year. And that's exactly what it was. He was in kindergarten in seventh grade, and we were teaching him eighth grade so he could math. And it's pretty telling about what a lot of our kids, their limited experience in education is within 12 months sometimes.
Well, Ms. Vasquez, I suspect the school district is becoming adept at being able to powerfully move those kind of students forward? Or are there still challenges that you face in that regard?
Well, I think we as a district have made leaps and bounds over the years. But granted, there's always new challenges, actually depending on the number of students we have, depending on their proficiency levels, depending on their language backgrounds. And so, granted, you know, we have our Burmese students, we have one lone Chinese student in the mix of our majority of Somali and Spanish-speaking students. You know, one thing that has served us well is, again, finding qualified people within those minority communities to help us with the communication between families and the school, though we're always looking to enhance that. But, again, now we're struggling with some new language groups, and so that's one distinct difference that, you know, being 100 miles away from the metro area, we're not able to access resources that maybe some schools can share back and forth easily here in the metro area.
Yeah, I think that's a point well taken. We certainly did hear from St. Paul earlier that when it came to the Koran reality, that looked a lot more like your reality in this case. And that, I think, was primarily because that was just an incredible explosion that happened where there really was no Koran established community anywhere in Minnesota at that time. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Vasquez, you put something on the table that other speakers, I don't believe, have. And that is and I'm just wondering if you could share your observations, speaking to the impact that the parents' education level has on the child as a EL learner. And secondly, what I often hear ELL teachers talk about is the depth of the student's understanding in their own native language and the impact that then has on their ability to learn English, and that we tend to treat all English language learners as the same. And I'm wondering, my understanding is that's not the case, and I'm wondering if you could just make any observations.
You know, the example that the Bloomington administrator gave about, you know, the animals in the pen and the child looks at the mm-hmm. pen. I mean, it's common that things like that are misunderstood by our students, and the challenge then is to make sure that teachers are realizing that as well, and that through more professional development and more knowledge of strategies that we'll be able to kind of fix isn't the word, but make them more aware of using different synonyms and different explanations and more visuals with a lot of these students. And yes, background is big. Even with our parents, you know, we just assume so much. And many times when I see teachers or administration asking parents to try and understand something, well, they try their darndest, but they have nothing to grasp from. They have never, many of them have had experience in school. So when we're asking them to understand how important it is that our student be at school every day at the same time in order not to miss lessons, it's very hard when they themselves have never had to have that sort of structured experience. And so it's very challenging working with our parents. But that's when we have qualified liaisons from those minority groups to help us out. That's been a godsend for us. We have some wonderful ones. But still, you know, there's always that, you know, you just wonder if they're understanding because of such a lack of our culture and background of what we think is common, ordinary things.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Vasquez. Let me ask both the Bloomington and St. Paul schools. It's going to get a little crowded up there, but if you can come forward, because I think there's some kind of nice segues here. And we just spoke about the parent involvement component. But, you know, but the three of you, Ms. Vasquez, you can stay there. The three of you have in common, you're all school districts. So let's just have a conversation with school districts right now. We will let you choose which questions you want to start off with that were posed to you. And we'll kind of let you, you know, you're educators. I'm sure you can choreograph this collegially and collaboratively and efficiently, probably perhaps far better than we can. So, Mr. Kubas, looks like you're ready to go.
Well, you had asked a specific question about our kinder prep model, and so I wanted to respond to that question. You know, this is we ended last school year with the kinder prep model. We had those 4-year-olds at our school for about 3 months. So we're into February now, so this will be the first full year of Kinder Prep. But I believe your question was around data and transitions and things like that. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what we do. I think the biggest value of the Kinder Prep program is that it's right on site at Valley View. So the four-year-olds are at Valley View. They are now Valley View students. And by proxy, that means their parents are Valley View parents. And so we really try to capitalize on that by making sure that we include them in anything that might be traditional K-5 school has now become pre-K-5, that they're invited to our dances and our family academies. They're invited to parent-teacher conferences, everything to indoctrinate them into our culture. Part of the rationale behind that is to make sure that we are developing relationships with families when their kids are four. And if we can do that and get them engaged in our school in an authentic way, and to kind of go back to what I was talking about before, about, if I sit across at the supper table from my wife and tell her all the things she did wrong that day, that's not going to go very well. And it's the same thing with parents. If we sit across from them and tell them all the things they're doing wrong, that's not really an authentic relationship. And so capitalizing on their experiences, which are varied and vast, and bringing those experiences into our school, it really helps with that transition. From a technical standpoint, we have our kindergarten teachers who are about 30 feet away from the Kinder Prep model. They meet with the Kinder Prep teachers to talk about what are you teaching, what are we teaching, where is the carryover, what are we missing, and being able to fill some holes in there. And I think that's really important from a transition standpoint as well. Another part of transitions that really works well is we're able to have conversations about kids, and we know who we're talking about, where they are academically and socially, and then put them in a good position to be successful. So the transition went well last year. We anticipate it going really well again this year. We're learning every year, but in all candor, we've been doing this for about 15 minutes, but we think things are going well. From a relationship standpoint, we have a family academy that we invite all of our Kinder Prep families to. We've got good attendance there. Ironically, there's one happening tonight. Just by design and the way it's worked out, many of our family academy attendees are our EL families. And so that works out well. Again, it's another opportunity for us to engage in an authentic relationship with those families. Tonight's topic will be about moving and the stress that puts on families. We're trying to reach out in a little bit of a way to make sure that we are developing an infrastructure for these families so they don't move. We're trying to get engaged with these families when their kids are 4 years old and giving them as many answers as we can and helping them learn advocacy skills so that they don't move, because we saw the data about what it means like in Bloomington when they stay. And so we think we're on to something pretty good with the Kinder Prep. Again, we're early in its infancy in implementation, but we're working on transitions, and we're making sure that those dovetail nicely.
St. Paul, why don't you go next? If you recall your questions.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I'm sorry. If you recall your questions, if you can jump next.
I would ask Dr. McCullough to talk about the extra hour and what you have experienced. I have my own biases, but he's living it every day.
Sure. Thank you very much. And again, to respond to the question about isn't it good for all kids? Well, of course it's good for all kids. That's why we do it with all kids. Okay. What we do, though, it's based on what the students' needs are, and we're starting to talk about individual education and individualized instructions. Some kids need an extra hour of biology every day. Other kids don't need an extra hour of biology. They might need more language skills and again, it's not just for our ELL students. Some of our kids just struggle. My own daughter's in ninth grade. She just struggles with writing. I mean, she's a smart kid. She's a bright kid. But if she went to Washington, she would spend an extra hour a day in writing because she struggles a little bit with writing. So it's based on what the needs of the kids are. And we fund it a number of different ways. Some of the money we get through the extended day money through the state. We get Title I money that we fund it through. We have partners that we fund it through. We write grants. But again, extended day is good for all kids. It's just that extra amount of time, because if we're expecting all kids to get to those high standards, if we want the ELL bar to get up to the same bars as the rest of the bars, no matter whose graphs you were looking at, we're going to have to give these kids more time, whether it's in the summer, whether it's during the school year, in order to help those kids be more successful.
So a couple of themes here of questions. I remember Senator Nelson asking more than once about sort of this concept of customization. Mm-hmm. Customization, there are issues here around time, and then there's this sort of even broader kind of thing that I'm hearing about, but I guess I'm looking for some affirmation about how you approach your work. I don't think you're describing to us approaches that are limited to working with only one population of students, even though it starts there, even though it's informed by there. It sounds like you've got something perhaps much more comprehensively running through your entire school districts. Am I overreaching, or is that an important observation to make?
I don't want to jump in here for everybody, speak for everybody, but good instruction is good instruction.
That's right.
Having parents appreciate coming to school, it doesn't matter what your background is. If they're making parents feel more comfortable by having, like we do with the family academies or parent academies in a home language, or having parent academies with somebody that calls them on the phone and invites them or is their neighbor or whatever. So a lot of these tenants work regardless of what the background is. What we have to remember with second language learners, and I think some people brought it up, is that a lot of these parents, they haven't come through our educational system. They don't get the idea that you're supposed to go to parent conferences every couple times a year and to find out how your kids are doing. But if they have somebody that speaks their language, call and tell them, hey, this is important, this is how you get involved. All of these people want their kids to be successful. If you talk to our second language learners, even though they have the results are less than academically our native-born speakers, they're all planning on their kids going to college. Because like I said before, they get the American dream. So it's our job as educators to figure out the tools that we need to give the kids as well as the parents in order to close those gaps. But you're exactly right. Good instruction is good instruction. Good parent involvement is good parent involvement. It's just how do we get the kids and the families engaged in this at a high level so that they can be successful.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to follow up on that because that's a very important point, and I think we miss it too often, is that we assume things are happening at the home that may not be, but you've hit it, and that is they want their kids to be successful. And I think too often as policymakers, we miss that. And we can go back to our own experiences and say, I certainly want all of my kids to be experienced, and we have to take that and put it to the ESL students. They want that as well. And so I just want to commend you and thank you for bringing that point because that's just very, very important. And we know how important it is when those students have the support at home that equates to those graduation rates, that equates to success. So thank you for bringing that up.
So let me tell you a story because it kind of when I went to the WAD, to the refugee camp, we brought bags with materials for the student. It said St. Paul Public Schools. So what, about 2 or 3 years ago, I was at the 10 top students for every high school. We do a big lunch on dessert time kind of, and we celebrate. And here I was welcoming the parents, and one of the parents come and said, thank you very much. And the student is standing next to him, and he said, you don't remember me. It's really hard to say to a parent, no, I don't. But I just said, your face is familiar. What else are you going to say? He said, you give me this bag, and he showed me the bag that I gave it to him in Thailand. And he said, my kids are in St. Paul. I have 5 kids in St. Paul. This is the first one graduated, and he was going to jail, university. And I'm just making sure that I pronounce the E's right. And he wasn't going to Yale. It's like Yale. University.
Both publicly supported.
Just in case. And he was going there, and he was the 4th in the class. So it was all about high expectations, and he did it in 4 years. Yes, he did have some schooling in his country, which it helped him to go ahead. But in general, I think what it makes all of us to do better is when people believe in ourselves, and we have ways to provide the support. And as Mike and we look at what he does in his schools, he has over 2,000 kids, but the teachers know the kids. Everybody is a community, and I please welcome you to go and visit. That school was almost 300 students 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And then I said, Mike, it's your job to turn it around. And here he has made able to do what he has done in that school. And I wanted to say that because he is one of those principals who is a turnaround principal.
Thank you, Dr. Silva. And I think that for us, what is at least for me, members, I presume it is for you too, is so important to hear kind of how themes kind of repeat themselves, although you are in rural Minnesota, you are in an urban core, suburban, and the themes that I hear, and we want to hear more from you, are expanded time. We need to give these opportunities to the district to do that. And I'm going to read what I heard, but I think what is important is that you know that Chair Mariani and I have been trying to figure out, although we understand that each district faces kind of their own individual significant challenges and opportunities, and they are unique and different, we have the responsibility to capture all of these common elements that we can help you with, and perhaps this legislation that we will be moving forward will help us expand resources, but also help you kind of put it together so that these systems of support, these pillars that you described today, are in that legislation so that everybody can kind of take it in the direction that works best for you. But we hear some very common themes. I heard, you know, expanded time, the need for more teachers that are well prepared to serve these different populations, the academic language development and understanding what that is, understanding how assessments actually work and can be done effectively for placement of children, parent engagement and family support, experiential learning. It's a key component for all learning, but for this particular population. How do we collect data, and how do we use that data effectively for the state of Minnesota and for you individually? How do we address trauma? Because many of these kids come from very traumatic experiences. Learning that culture matters in academic growth, and how do we do this adaptation? And then measures. You know, how do we do testing? Is it appropriate to test EL kids the same way we test other kids? And then constant evaluation of what works and what doesn't, and then sharing best practices. So I got those elements. I hope members got a few others, but I thought that those were very themes that were common across districts and regions. Thank you for that. And I would like to invite now the University of Minnesota and the department representatives, so that we can, members, could you make sure that your question is addressed? Because we took some notes on kind of the very general terms, but if your question is not being answered, and you know, we really want you to get an answer. So if you could take a few minutes to go over some answers to the questions that you were able to capture, and just briefly, we will have another opportunity to go in depth into those answers. But for now, if you could just respond briefly to some of those questions, and members, if you did not hear your a response to your question, please make sure you ask that question. Please go ahead.
I'd like to begin with the question by, your name tag is partly obscured. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought this was it. Senator Nino, this was regarding seat time promotion. It was a very quick point that we made on a slide, and I'd like to clarify that this addresses high school level in our recommendation and refers to promotion based from one WIDA English proficiency level to the next. So we're not talking about grade level promotion. That might be a different kind of issue. Is indeed a different issue in elementary, for instance. We're talking about when a student comes in and is tested English at level one. And in some districts, what we're seeing is that student, even if they enter the school as a newcomer in the spring of a year as level one, will automatically be promoted to level two in the fall of that year, even though English gains don't indicate that promotion to be appropriate. So that's what that refers to. And what we see that the negative consequence of that is that a student will then receive a level two schedule without actually having been assessed again, and indeed is not at level two, and that schedule doesn't meet the student's learning needs and in fact causes a hindrance for their development. So that's the nature of that recommendation. Does that respond to your question?
Senator Nino.
So how do you prevent that from happening?
Reasonable assessment needs to be done as a type of a exit criteria from one level to the next. So in order for a student to be placed in the next English level, it's reasonable to know that there's a reason why they have shown those skills and that they are ready for the curriculum that is offered at that level. It's really not a very difficult fix, but what we see often is that it's simply circumvented and that there's a seat time promotion for reasons that I think haven't been researched, but that we see in practice. And that's why we are recommending that this this be reviewed and amended, as it inhibits, it's inappropriate for their needs.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, are you suggesting then that the alignment of the WEDA standards with the language arts standards, that alignment is missing? Might that be part of the problem? Because I hear a conflict or a contradiction in your answer to Senator Nienau about the WEDA standard versus the standard for which the MCA is given. So, you know, are they not aligned? Are we not providing enough training so teachers see that that connection between both the WEDA and the MCA standard?
Thank you for the question. I think it may not even rise to that level of scrutiny. This is the kind of decision that it's made within the ESL department of a school or of a district. Mm-hmm. So typically MCA scores are not even referenced in these kind of promotion decisions. Sometimes it's just an issue of let's move them through in an allotted amount of time without regard to actual learning gains.
Yeah, okay.
Another phenomenon that we've seen that is equally unfortunate is when students are placed into the wrong class and then are kind of warehoused there until they age out. Mm-hmm. So somebody else, Representative Nelson, I think, asked about customized instruction.
Yes, right
here. Senator.
That was Senator. Senator Nelson.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that kind of speaks to a lot of these issues, is the need for appropriate placement, and then once they're there, appropriate instruction. And we all know that same is not equal. And the SLIF kids in even level one ESL classes need different kinds of instruction. So, I mean, some easy remedies to this include making sure there's a plan for basic literacy instruction. I mean, we're talking phonics and phonemics, the most basic literacy instruction that even an ESL level one class has kind of moved beyond, you know, by October and November. You know, they're moving on. So when a newcomer is placed in that setting, they need a different path to be able to access just the regular curriculum. And I think that a lot of this can be addressed by class size and co-teaching. Also, working and recruiting more multilingual ESL teachers and multilingual teachers in general. Representative or Senator Francis asked about... She asked about... what we need in Minnesota in terms of ESL teachers. So I'm kind of trying to go fast through a lot of these questions. But there isn't a huge lack of ESL teachers, but we need ESL teachers that are prepared to work with the diversity of English learners. We need ESL teachers who are multilingual. And then we need content teachers who are prepared and administrators who also get this. And I think that we can see examples of administrators who do get this here today, but I feel like that's there's a gap in competency in terms of administrators being able to really assess teachers as they're using SLIFE strategies.
Very good.
I'd like
Senator
to follow
Senator Clausen, you had a question. Okay. I think he's been trying to get our attention.
Thank
I'm
you.
Sorry, I yeah. cannot see you.
I had earlier mentioned that I think using the MCA exams were actually testing for negative results because many students are not prepared within that 12-month framework to adequately show their knowledge. Would you be in favor of, this is a leading question, but I think what we really need to do is to assess individual growth over a period of time and use that as the standard for moving from level to level, not using seat time. I think many times schools are a little bit confused after a year, what do we do with the student?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think using assessments correctly and looking at individual growth and then placing students in the appropriate program is a direction we need to go as a state.
Yeah, we would agree.
May I take that?
Yeah.
Absolutely right. I think it begins with even asking the question, have you been to school before? And that's where the data collection needs to begin. But there are models, and it was Senator Yaruso who asked about not reinventing the wheel. There are models and approaches that have been shown in research to be of benefit. For instance, Boston's Hyde Park School is a newcomer school for SLIFE students, and they did research there to show that a newcomer program is more effective than trying to push SLIFE students into premature co-teaching, which has not been shown in any research to be effective, not in any research. In Minnesota, Worthington Public Schools is starting a newcomer program for high school SLIFE students, and that is really good to see. Here in the Twin Cities, the Fairview Alternative High School in Roseville is a program where high school SLIFEs can get appropriate instruction tailored to their level, and it all comes back to what this legislation is calling for, meaningful access to the curriculum. What constitutes high standards for a student who has beginning academic skills? It's not the same as what constitutes high standards for another student who has had age-level education. So I agree completely that looking at students as individuals from the moment they begin and throughout their learning path you could title our recommendation in that way.
Well,
thank
you very much. We've run out of time, and we do need to bring the department. So thank you. Absolutely, we will be consulting with you again, and we will be working very closely with the university to
We would like to work
figure
on a timeline to achieve these policy recommendations.
Yeah, thank you very much. We will definitely get together soon again.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for all of your great questions. Just in the interest of time, I did want to offer if it might be easier for us to just respond in writing, seeing a number of members have left, or otherwise we can walk through them now, whichever you would prefer.
Well, let's do a brief, just very brief, and then obviously we will have an opportunity to do that. And very definitely, I think members would like to have perhaps some responses in writing, so that would be...
Okay, so Madam Chair, Representative Mariani had asked about longitudinal data and kind of the trends that we see, especially with MCAs. And it's always the problem that we run into with the MCAs that when we change the standards and we align the assessments with the standards that tend to be more rigorous, especially our new math test, which was started in 2011, and the reading test, which was started in 2013. That the comparability of data between those two tests is not really apples to apples. So, you know, it's always that struggle. Do you have the, you know, standards that are maybe out of date, and then you're gathering this trends data, or do you start a new test and kind of start the trend from point A? So, unfortunately for math, you know, we only have reliable trend data starting in 2011, and we're just starting to build that trend for 2013 in reading. Kind of the two policy things you had asked for, in speaking with staff, you know, and these aren't necessarily statutory changes either, but, and you heard it a lot from the other testifiers, that getting the WIDA toolkit and training on that toolkit out to the content area teachers, as opposed to just the EL teachers, we feel that that's really essential to making sure that all students are you know, picking up their scores on the MCAs. When it comes to the other thing was increased parent engagement, which obviously we heard just constantly today that you have a lot of families that have come from countries where parent engagement just wasn't common or wasn't being used, and we really need to do our best to get those parents involved. Senator Nelson, you had asked about that grad rate data, and I think we'll just pull that together and email that to you if that's all right. We'll email it to the rest of the committee. Representative Swatsky had asked about how the math MCA is presented in terms of, you know, is it computational in nature? I think we would say that, it's a federal requirement, first of all, for all EL students to take the federal accountability math exams. It's not just something that we as a state do. It is a federal requirement. It's not entirely computational. There are some that are word-based, but we could send you some sample questions to kind of show you the ones that maybe aren't entirely computational in nature. Representative Yaruso had a question about ASL. ASL, which is American Sign Language, is not included in the EL counts. You also had a question about whether these are just five-year kids or over 5 years that was in our data, and it is all kids who are identified as EL, whether or not they're still generating EL aid. Representative Erickson had asked for an update on the longitudinal data system. I'll get you the Office of Higher Ed kind of runs that in coordination with us, so maybe I'll work with them to get you an update in writing on that that we can send out
and
to the committee.
Send Senator Polgar-Miller to see me.
Will do.
And Representative Mariani.
Right. And there were some questions that you had about kind of tracking progress throughout the 5 years, and I know it's been discussed here that, you know, districts, they set their own entrance and exit criteria. They've got access that can be used as a tool to, you know, determine proficiency and be used as exit criteria, but not all districts necessarily do that. There's other tools that districts use based upon the needs that they see in their students in their community. So there is some of that tracking that's going on at a district level of kind of ramping up intensity over 5 years, but that's not necessarily something that's a statewide policy. Moving on to Representative Kreisha's question about kind of generational questions. Students are identified by home language and the assessment. There's not generational progress that's tracked at a state level as far as, you know, this child is a first-generation student, second-generation student. We do track kids that are new to country because obviously we need to know that information for the MCA reading test. Senator Clausen had had a question about beyond 5 years, if children are still receiving instruction, I think that's been testified to, that, yep, we've got a number of districts that beyond 5 years, they're still seeing a need to provide instruction to those children, and that's happening. The characteristics of those are not necessarily ones that we have good data on, I don't think, but, you know, the U of M does have some of that data, I think, that they've shared with you today and that we can continue to work on. Senator Clausen, you had mentioned the testing for negative results. I think that goes back to what we talked about earlier with making sure that the WIDA toolkit is being used by content area teachers and that it's not just an EL thing that we're talking about here. But again, you know, we've got these federal requirements that, you know, we were able to get some flexibility with the NCLB waiver, but that's one of the things we're still bound by as a state. And then Senator Torres-Ray, I think it was your last question about the discrepancy in the data that your staff had pulled together and our staff. I think we'll just have our staffs kind of sit together and figure out where our numbers are a little bit different there, but I'm sure we can figure that out. We did do the addition, and you're right. It is 65% of our students, actually a little more than that, who are under grade 5. Some of the reason for that, I think, is because, you know, as they get older, you see kids, kids dropping out, which is a whole nother problem, you know, when it comes to graduation rate. But you're right, it is a total younger population. I think that pretty much covers the questions that were out
Thank
there.
You.
But if there's other things, obviously, you can get staff my contact information if you don't already have it. And
Thank you. And you were present, you know, during this conversation. I would like to make a request. I would like to have the commissioner give us really from her perspective, kind of what are some of the key elements that she recognizes to be relevant, that she hears from the different districts around all of these issues that you heard today in terms of parent engagement, data collection, age, you know, approach to target younger years versus, you know, older. How do we deal with the issues affecting these you know, really important population, although it may be a small population, but the kids who come without academic, you know, preparation at all. So I would like to hear from a commissioner's perspective kind of what is your recommendation or what are some of the best practices, some of the key elements that you would like to see in terms of policy so that Representative Mariani and I can begin to grasp all of that from her perspective, from the you know, the research perspective offered by the University of Minnesota, by the kind of implementation perspective offered by the different districts. We will be compiling all of that information and putting together a proposal for the different members. Senator Nelson, you had a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very briefly, one, I want to thank you and Chair Mariani for holding this hearing. I think this is very important, and I've come away with some things that I think we can work on in a toolbox. But there's one element that I just heard addressed briefly from the University of Minnesota folks, and I don't want us to lose it in our discussion, in this comprehensive discussion. And that had to do with the answer to Senator Franzen's question about ELL teachers and the fact that we're not short necessarily on quantity of ELL teachers. But I heard you say that perhaps the teachers that we have may not have had the preparation needed to meet the needs. And I thought I also heard you mention the same about principals. And so it seems to me that one of the elements we should look at as we address this concern about our making sure our ELL learners are adequately paired, prepared and graduating on time is looking at teacher preparation for our ELL teachers. And that might be something with the Board of Teaching to look at.
I think this is a very important question, and I would like to ask the university to address it because we heard something completely different. So we've heard that there is a significant deficit on teachers teaching ELL students, teaching children with disabilities. We have a deficit in rural Minnesota. We have significant deficits within cohorts of teachers in the state of Minnesota to a point that we're in a crisis. So if you could address that, because I think that we need a clarification on that point.
Right. I mean, I think that we feel that the people who come out of our programs are very well prepared to deal with these issues. And there are many other programs, of course, in addition to ours, which are also preparing ESL teachers. The need for ESL teachers keeps growing, and it keeps moving around. And so I'm certain that there are some of the rural areas have more of a need for that than, you know, some of the other areas where maybe they have more candidates available. We had mentioned the need for more preparation for other teachers because the ESL teacher cannot do the job alone.
Okay.
So in other words, all of the teachers in the school need to take responsibility for those students. The ESL teacher should be the language expert who is providing that special language instruction together and, you know, in collaboration with the content teachers. But the content teachers sometimes don't understand what their role is. They don't understand maybe that they also need to take responsibility for these students and that they need to co-teach, that this ESL teacher who comes to work with them is not an aide. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's the kind of professional development that I think we're talking about. And having leadership in the school that really understands that it is also really key. And if I can just throw in one more thing about kind of the whole demand for teachers, we are seeing a decrease in the number of applications to our programs, not just our particular program, but all of the programs at the University of Minnesota for teachers, which seems to be part of a national trend. So, I mean, this is another kind of huge area to think about. But just, I mean, one barrier that's very obvious is the cost involved in investing in a teacher education program like ours, which is full-time and which is not cheap. And so providing some kind of scholarships or, you know, loan forgiveness programs, I think, would be one way that we could try to address this problem.
Thank you. And just as you know, we will be talking about that.
Right.
There will be a hearing specifically on that, and we're going to hear some of the statistics that you provided and some others have provided to the chair and myself to really address this critical issue that we're facing in Minnesota in terms of groups. I really have to end it because members really, this is 2:30.
One more last
so,
word?
Just really I mean, it has to be very fast.
One of the greatest predictors. Sorry, Beth. For success in school for English learners is formal schooling and literacy in their first language. We need policy to develop more programs to provide that for students, and we will definitely need teachers in that area.
Thank you. Thank you. We will continue the conversation. Members, Representative Mariani?
Thank you. Thank you, members.
Okay. Thank you, and we will adjourn now. Thank you.